Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Forged from his Memphis gospel roots and his 1980s initiation into the thriving Houston nightclub scene, Kirk Whalum's unique sound leaves an indelible imprint on each listener. And it was in Houston where jazz pianist Bob James discovered him. After moving to Los Angeles, Kirk became an in-demand session player for top artists such as Barbra Streisand, Luther Vandross, Quincy Jones, and most notably Whitney Houston. It's his sax heard on the mega hit I Will Always Love You. His chart-topping For You and his Gospel According to Jazz series featuring the great George Duke and Jonathan Butler, among others, in addition to his 30-plus solo projects, have rendered Whalum a singular artist. He was a member of the soul jazz supergroup BWB, which features Kirk as the W, along with good friends Rick Braun and Norman Brown. Kirk has earned a theology master's and passionately serves his community when his touring schedule allows. His daily 15-minute podcast, The Bible in Your Ear, has reached over a million listeners. Kirk's passion for education includes students from Memphis to Kenya. A 12-time Grammy Award nominee, Kirk won his first Grammy Award in 2011 for Best Gospel Song, It's What I Do, featuring Lala Hathaway alongside gifted songwriter Jerry Peters. With a brass note on the Memphis Walk of Fame and a star on the Nashville Walk of Fame, Tennessee has honored Whalum proudly. Hearing Kirk Whalum live is a unique and enriching experience every time. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Kirk Whalum. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Yes, it's such a pleasure and an honor to be with you. Of course, I love South Africa. I'm among the many who love that place. And I will, when I'm done, I will be drinking a cup of rooibos. This morning is Five Roses. In the afternoon is rooibos. At any rate, I am in a place called Soulsville, USA. Some know it as Memphis, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you say you're from Memphis, a certain world, global population, immediately two words come out. Elvis Presley. I say, yes, but what Elvis would say to you is that, oh, no. It's about the blues. It's about gospel. It's about soul music. That's what Memphis is all about.
Okay, so now let's rewind. I know you've had a multi-decade generational tour in the entertainment world. At what age did you decide, cool, I want to be in this entertainment world, whether it was a child or teenager? And Kirk's journey in that space, I know it's many generations or decades, so the hybrid version of Kirk's story.
Oh, man. So you mentioned the generations and decades. That definitely, I go, man, is it? I guess you're right. But I am grateful for every one of those years. And yes, I started at 12 playing the saxophone because I heard my uncle Peanuts. They called him Peanuts. In fact, he kind of has a following there. He's in heaven now, but following in South Africa. Okay. Hugh Peanuts Whalum was about 5'6", in terms American, you know, we say inches and feet and inches.
Yeah, yeah.
They call him Peanuts because he was so short. But yes, he played years ago. He played with Nat King Cole. I mean, he was one of those musicians from St. Louis, Missouri, who kind of made a bit of a splash in the big ocean. And he was my inspiration. I started playing the saxophone at 12. I knew long before then that music was my passion. You know, my dad was a pastor. Mom was a first lady. Also, she was a model. But, you know, being around the church, that was my life. And you could always find me wherever the instruments were, being annoying and obnoxious to, you know, the people who actually were qualified to play those instruments. But I was hanging around. And, after that, things got crazy, man. I started touring.
At what age did you start touring?
You could say, you know, when I was, I'd say around, I was born in 58, around 19, 81, I started from my home at that time, Texas Southern University in Houston, an HBCU. I started touring further around Texas, so Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth. But then in 84, I was heard by the great Bob James. I opened with my band. We opened the concert for him. That's the terminology we use in the States. I opened the show.
Yeah.
And he says that the audience peaked before he got on stage, which he said was not good. And so he hired me. He said, I can't have that happen again. And so I was touring with him now from 85, you know, for about 10 years, really, off and on. And yeah, then Whitney Houston and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that touring stuff really started in 85. Wait, we did tour overseas. I mean,
yeah.
I didn't come to South Africa with him, but I went a whole lot of places in the East and in Europe. And then it was with Whitney Houston in 94, the big year, that I first came to South Africa.
Oh, I was in that audience. I was there.
I thought you looked familiar.
You thought, that's so funny. Okay, so now, obviously, you, when performing live, you perform as your sort of own headline act with your own band, and then you also perform with artists, as you mentioned, Bob James and Whitney Houston. So yes. What is the difference for you in approach in each of those situations? And do you enjoy both or having a balance of both in your repertoire?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, when I was invited by a new friend named Ricky Minor, who eventually became like the it guy in Los Angeles for, you know, any big show, the Oscars, the Grammys, the whatever. But at the time, he was a bass player for Whitney Houston. And I played a gig with him, and he, the next day, called me and said, he played a gig for me. I called him to play on my gig. And then the next day, he said, well, I was kind of listening to you too, because I just got promoted to musical director for Whitney. And I would like for you to be in her band. In that moment, I knew that instinctively that this was not such a given, you know, like this big gig, big money, big, all everything big. But the little train, the little engine that could, you know, I mean, if you're not watching me, I'm making one of those sort of, you know, it's a gradual ascent, you know, yes. Incremental is what I was doing, you know, in my little career, as it were. At the time, and I didn't think this was necessarily a great thing for me to do, because I felt like it would be a distraction.
Okay.
You know, I'd be so busy touring with her, and that did happen like that, you know. And people say, well, oh man, people are gonna know you because you're Whitney's sax player. I'm like, not so much. I mean, because Whitney's audience was, you know, 13-year-olds, you know, 20-year-olds, and then more people. But the point is that they didn't really care who I was.
Yeah,
but eventually that turned around. In fact, I remember distinctly saying to us, she said, if you can use my name, use it. She said, but it's not going to always help. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry, use my name if it'll help, but it's not going to always help. That was the quote.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it really didn't help at first, because I was one of the legion of people who support her and make her look good, which I love, you know, doing.
Mm.
But eventually, again, especially after she passed, you know, I could say that the saxophone solo I played on I Will Always Love You is the saxophone solo that's been heard by more people than any other sax solo in history, right?
Yeah.
So I just being able to say that is one hell of a calling card, and it was a gift from her.
So you also were on the recording, the album recording, am I correct?
Yes. So in other words, she did it live to the film. That was a thing that a lot of people don't realize, is that, you know, not only did she do it live to the film, much to the chagrin of the producers and the director, all those people were against that idea, because it's just not a good idea, you know, sonically, to try to be making a record and filming a scene
yes.
at the same time. But she said, this is how I'm going to do it. And my band is going to play live as I do it. By the way, I'm writing a book about that whole thing, as well as her funeral. about a vision I had at her funeral. I could talk to you about it. But yes, that was, yeah, that was a thing.
You mentioned that sonically. So just getting to the technical side of things, because a lot of people don't realize this. So when we watch movies and we see people singing, it is a backing track, correct? Because why is it preferred?
Right. It's preferred because you the producer has more control, right? The main thing is separation. Right? That's the very big thing. Separation, because records that we listen to have been, the elements are separate, right? On a multi-track tape, right?
Yes.
You my fingers. And so we can take this element, we can EQ it, we can compress it, we can, you know, deal with it, add effects or whatever. Now we go to the next track and then we put it all together and it sounds awesome. But if we can't separate, you know, as producers, you know, we get nervous because you're kind of stuck with what we call bleed, like one thing bleeds into the next. And so if you're EQing the snare drum, you're also EQing Whitney's vocal, you know, so that's not really good. But, you know, there's that part in as well, just the aspect of making a record, you're focusing on different things. Making a movie, you know, seeing they got to be concerned with lighting and wardrobe and you know, the hair styling and whatever. You know, there's too many things, and they shoot that scene over and over from angles. They want to get different angles on it. So you can't be singing like that, not like she sings, 50 times, you know, but that's what you do when you're making a movie. Ask any actor and they'll tell you, you know.
Yeah. A lot of people who aren't in the industry don't realize that.
They make it, and our job is to make it look like we're all doing it at once. And the average music video that people love and they're watching, they're like, oh, this person is singing. No.
No, yes, I know that.
Studio.
Yes.
And they superimposed it onto that video.
Exactly, there's a backing track. Because, yeah, exactly. Like, if you look at music videos, if they're outside, if there's, you know, all these different things, sounds and all these other things that come into play, that if it was sung live, it would not, it would sound terrible because there would be all these different things, logically, if you think of it. But a lot of people not in the industry, the fans, don't realize that.
Right, and that's okay. You know, I mean, it's not so much what they should be concerned with. It's like, do I like it or not, you know, and does it sound good to me? And that's great. I mean, especially now, Barrett, I mean, listen, with, you know, the treatment that they're using now on so many of the vocals, you know, pitch correct and auto-tune and all that, like, you don't really know how that person sounds, you know.
Yes. Am I correct in understanding? So you play the saxophone, but you also write and compose music. Is it instrumental music or music with words?
So I have a Grammy for composing a song with lyrics. And it's the only Grammy I have, and it's called, and it was Gospel Song of the Year, which is still to this day, I go, I can't believe I got that Grammy because I'm not technically a gospel artist.
Yes.
But it was called It's What I Do. And don't wonder why, don't bother asking how, God, you can love someone like me. And he said, don't bother asking that. It says, because you're mine, because you're you. It's because I'm love.
Yes.
It's what I do. And I do write lyrics and vocal songs. I just don't do it nearly as much as instrumental. So to answer your question, probably 95% instrumental songs.
And then do you sing?
I do sing.
Okay.
All I've been blessed with in this life. But I don't sing a lot. I mean, it's, you know, I sing through my instrument. I feel like that's the voice that people recognize when they hear me. And my wife even says, like, she can be riding in the car and she'll hear me play something on a record that she didn't know I was on, say a Michael McDonald record or Luther Vandross or something that she didn't know that particular session I did. And then when I start to play, she like looks around like she said, just in that instant, she feels like I said something to her.
Yeah.
But it's
okay. So when you play on these other artists' tracks, you mentioned Michael McDonald, et cetera, et cetera. How much input do you have in what you creating for that song, or were you completely directed and produced by someone else?
Oh, that's a really good question. So it tends to vary. And I'll say that earlier in my career, when it wasn't so much oh, this is Kirk Whalum doing this, as much as it was, oh, this producer heard about this guy, this young guy, who this producer liked him, you will like him too, let's try him, you know. Then, yeah, you're kind of in there and you do whatever they ask you to do. You try to put your personality and in the track. But yeah, there tended to be more kind of directing, except for producers like Quincy Jones, who first time I recorded with him, I was probably 30. And he just said, here's the song, basically, you know. Because, you know, he knows that was his whole thing. Like, reason he was such a great producer is because he knew who to call for that role, right? And so once he called that person, he wasn't going to tell you how to do it. It's like, no, you do what you do. That's why you're here. But later on, you know, now when I don't do as many of those kinds of sessions. I just played a session for Doc Powell, one of my favorite artists, guitarist. I play flute. And yeah, we go back and forth a little bit. Hey, try it like this and that type of thing. It's just mutual respect. And I want him to be happy. So, you know, I'm like, oh, here it is. And I've done it. And I'm not.
So, you mentioned you play flute and saxophone. What else do you play?
That's it, man. Yeah, tenor and soprano. I don't play alto.
Okay.
I play baritone. You see my baritone back here. But until my new record, I did not record anything on baritone. I just recorded my first song on baritone, and it's the title track of Epic Cool.
Okay, so then why had you not done it before, and what was the inspiration to do it now?
You know, the song, I was just kind of messing around with this idea, and I thought, would it be cool if I played this song on baritone? And because it's just got this vibe, epic cool, right? It's got this old school kind of vibe to it. Baritone has a different sound. It's like a big old husky sound. It's kind of, you know, raspy and that type of voice, you know. So it was just something fun to do. Too heavy to carry out on tour. That's why you will probably never see me playing it live.
So is the approach different when you put creating baritone to sort of soprano? You've already sort of referenced it, that it's heavier. So can you explain that a little bit more?
Oh, no. I meant just literally it weighs more.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like so carrying this thing on the road, especially now with the way, you know, air travel has changed drastically, right? So now it's like, well, you can carry one carry-on and one, you know, purse or whatever. So, you know, you just don't want to check all this stuff under the plane, man.
Oh, understand. I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you for you guys for the hard work that you do. I love the experience of the choice, the arrival, the unpacking, the listening from song one to whatever. I'm not sure if you're aware that CDs, vinyls, and cassettes are in a massive comeback. Vinyls in the UK alone last year, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. CDs are on, again, a slight upward trajectory, and even cassettes, can you believe? But then we've got these streaming platforms that people consume music on. So what is your observation and perception of the landscape where we're at now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't pretend to be an authority on that. I mean, you would think, but it's just hard to keep up. Like, I'm trying to keep up with what I'm doing, like the creative part, but the business part of it, the media that, you know, used to transport our music out into people's ears, you know, I don't pretend to understand the trends. You know, on the one hand, we had no choice but to get used to the idea of people streaming our music, technically for free, and, you know, sharing our music. That's something that was such a bitter pill to swallow, because for all those years, you know, like, I'm going to make this record and we'll invest in this thing and money, and then it's going to come out and hopefully people will buy it, because that'll enable us to make another record. But the way that has now, you know, drastically changed to this online presence and people listening to our music on their phones. And, you know, it's great in one sense because you have, you know, they have access to everybody's music right there on their phones. But the bad part, you're right, it's like there's the little of the magic of it. The mystery of it is lost, I think, with the loss of the actual product, the vinyl, the CDs. So maybe, you know, I'm with you. That would be such a lovely development. I think I would cry if it really did, you know, make its way back into the mainstream in that way, where I get a check in the mail and say, guess what? Some people bought your record.
Yeah.
I would cry.
You've been in the industry for a number of years, performing for a number of years. What keeps motivating you to create new stuff, get on stage and perform?
Man, I really do feel like at 65, like, I'll give you an example. When I was turning 60, I almost kind of woke up and startled in the night going like, wait a minute. Like 2 weeks ago, I was turning 40. And
yeah,
by that paradigm, 2 weeks from now, I'll be turning 80. You know, like just the way the time moves. And
yes,
you just kind of look around and, you know, you're 60. And I thought, there's a lot of things I have had on my list of things to do that were very important to me. One of them, the primary one, you know, besides just trying to represent God well and share the gospel of Jesus Christ and have people to know how much God loves them, the thing right under that is, or maybe connected to that, is traveling the world. You know, I want to be a global artist, and I learned French. I'm learning Spanish. I mean, I speak those languages partly because of the fact that I intend on being a global artist and not just, you know, like here in the States, you know, if you have an instrument and you're playing to kind of a groovy song that, you know, they call you a smooth jazz artist, and it's just a little hurtful, you know, you're like, wow, that's just such a tiny little corner of what, you know, what we do. But being a global artist was my objective when I did the Humanité record, where I went to 8 countries and did collaborations with 14 artists, you know, one of two of whom are South African. Well, actually, Jonathan Butler's not on this record, but I've recorded with him a lot. Andrea Lisa, my guitarist who tours with me now, is originally from there. And then the great Sahara, my God. I mean, even as I speak, it's the first interview I've done since she died, and it's just difficult for me to put my head around
the
fact that she's gone. But recording this project, my producer is from England, James McMillan, and we just got on planes and went to Indonesia and Japan and, you know, Kenya and, you know, all over the place, Paris and London, and just did collaborations with young artists. And that is a part of, because I was turning 60, I'm like, I can't just let this happen and not. Yeah. I just had to spend my own money, basically, and go out and do it.
So that's the latest album that you're referencing, correct?
Yes. The new one doesn't come out until May.
Okay. So then that was the previous one. So tell us about the new one that's coming out in May.
It's called Epic Cool, and it's all original compositions, which is kind of a risky thing to do. I mean, people are looking to hear a song they know already, you know, sometimes, and but not always. I mean, I think people like hearing new stuff that if they like it, they like it, right? And so I was produced on this one by an amazing, I call him Swiss Chocolate. He's a black Swissman, Greg Manning, who was doing very, very well out here as a solo artist. But he's also produced a lot of people and a lot of sax players for some reason. But he and I have been dear friends for years. I met him with Jonathan Butler. He was Jonathan's keyboard player for a few years.
Okay.
And so the new record, Epic Cool, all new music. Man, I'm so geeked about this record. And I know that's what we say, right? But no, I really am. I just love listening to it myself.
Cook, I love this game. I know if I had to answer this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 years, I know your answer will be different every time simply because there are millions of them. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to songs by other artists, 5 songs by other artists, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
Crusaders, Stomp and Buck Dance, Hank Crawford, Misty, Al Jarreau, Look to the Rainbow, Marvin Gaye, If I Should Die Tonight, Charles Lloyd, Forest Flower.
Lovely. Some of them on my list, some of them I need to add, so thank you for that. So, Kirk, the podcast is listened to throughout the world, so as a final message, what would you like to say?
Don't bother asking why a creator who we can't see or understand really would love you. It's because you're his, and I say his, we know that God is above gender, right? But it's because you're loved by one who knows all about you. And the music that I play, I'm hoping is pointing you in that direction. that you might not ever feel that you are alone or unloved, because you are not alone and you're not unloved.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.